I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The pandemic continues to disrupt and reorder the world of work. The Labor Department reported that 4.3 million Americans quit their jobs in August, led by workers in food service, hospitality, and retail, although the quit rate can be seen across a broad spectrum of the workforce. The anemic employment numbers for September, just 194,000 jobs added that month, were well below expectations. Digging a little deeper is a worrisome trend. 309,000 women quit or gave up looking for a job in September, largely because of childcare issues and school shutdowns because of the threat of COVID. But there are some positive notes from the pandemic. Many Americans saved more money, which has given them a cushion and, in some cases, the chance to rethink their work-life balance. Today in Radio Times, why people are quitting, what this means for individuals, for businesses and the overall economy, and how the pandemic has reshaped how we think about work. We have two guests. Anthony Klotz is Associate Professor of Management at Mays Business School at Texas A&M University. He came up with the term the Great Resignation. Anthony Klotz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And joining us by Skype is Betsy Stevenson. She's a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. She's also a faculty research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research and was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors from 2013 to 2015. Betsy, it's been a little while. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Well, let me just take a moment to reflect on the last year and a half and frankly, what we have all been through at the start of the pandemic when the economy was essentially shutting down. People were losing jobs. People were being sent home. If you were a frontline worker there, you were on the front lines, but without the protection of a vaccine. Many ghost towns across the country. It seems that we were dealing with, and I'll put this to you first, Anthony Klotz, both an economic but an existential crisis. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So during the pandemic, because of the lockdowns and because of the nature of the pandemic being something that causes illness and death, we had a number of individuals who were taking stock of their lives. And whenever these serious sorts of events happen, they often cause us to ask existential questions. And the lockdowns gave us the time to do that. And so these big, deep thoughts were what were going through a lot of people's minds over the course of the pandemic.
And you think it's sort of having its impact today?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of these thoughts have to do with how do I define the good life? How do I define well-being for myself? And am I on a trajectory in my life that's giving me the best possible amount of well-being? And in many cases, people reconsidered what their lives are and thought about a different direction. And for us, especially as Americans, much of our life satisfaction is tied up in our job satisfaction. And so for those who came to the conclusion, I need to make a change to my life, that often involved a change to their work as well.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Betsy. I'm curious about, as you look back over the last 18 months as an economist, what do you see?
I think it's important to start with just how different this recession was in terms of who it affected. In a normal recession, we see mostly people disproportionately in the goods producing sector losing their jobs, and that means disproportionately male. You know, women rarely lose anywhere near as many jobs as men. In some recessions, like the 2001 recession, the 1990s recession, the 1980s recession, you saw barely any decline in women's employment. And then what decline does happen recovers very, very quickly. And that's just because the way I like to describe it is, you know, in a normal recession, when you worry that you could lose your job, you don't stop going to get your hair cut, but right, you do think hard about big purchases like maybe that new deep freezer for your garage. The exact opposite happened during the pandemic. We all bought the deep freezer and we stopped getting our hair cut and stopped doing other in-person things. And so this is the first ever recession that really targeted the service sector. And that meant that a lot of very vulnerable workers, lower wage workers, were ones who lost their jobs right away. And that women lost more jobs than men. So women's employment declined 16%.
Wow.
At the very beginning of the recession compared to a 13% decline for men. And that might not sound even like that big of a difference, but it's actually quite big, particularly when you put it in that historical context where men, you know, men's employment declined almost 9% in that great recession we had, whereas women's employment had only declined about 4%. So normally women are the ones sort of holding the family together during a recession, keeping their jobs, and the exact opposite happened here. And I think that's shaken everyone up. And, you know, both men and women trying to think hard about what they want to do. And I think one last point I'll make on that is if you look at what happened to parents, people think a lot about who left their job, but the majority of parents made a career sacrifice, and it wasn't a career sacrifice about leaving their job.
Right.
So in a survey I recently did with RIWI, we showed that, you know, you had 15 to 20% of working parents who changed to more flexible work, another, you know, 10 to 15% who declined a promotion, people, another 10 to 15% that paused any kind of upskilling or education, and some of them just reduced their work hours. So there was a lot of career sacrifices, and now we're coming out of that, and they're saying, okay, well, what am I going to do now?
Well, let me go back to you, and it's interesting to sort of toggle back and forth between, you know, people who lost their jobs, and that's certainly one piece of the phenomenon, or sort of had to cut back on their employment. But Anthony Klotz, you're looking at people who are quitting their jobs, which is an interesting phenomenon. I'm assuming that happens all the time, but was there something about the pandemic that really has accelerated the quit rate?
Yeah, so it is a little bit counterintuitive with all the layoffs that we saw in 2020, then thinking about this large wave of resignations happening. But there were a few trends that I was observing that seemed unique to this pandemic. And maybe the biggest one is burnout. And I don't know that we've seen an event that has caused such widespread burnout across the economy as the pandemic. So you can imagine frontline workers, healthcare workers, were experiencing burnout during the pandemic. But also going back to women, a lot of people working from home who took on these extra caregiving and child education responsibilities alongside work were feeling burnt out. And I've also spoken to a lot of individuals towards the top of organizations, middle managers and upper managers, who managing during the pandemic was really stressful for them. And so I think we have an overall burnt out workforce right now. And for many individuals, the only way to cure burnout is to get a break from work. And in many cases, that's going to involve quitting for a period of time.
I was reading, and I'll go back to you, Anthony Klotz, but then to you, Betsy Stevenson, which is that during the pandemic, not everybody, of course, but a number of people were actually able to save money, and maybe in part helped by some of these government subsidies to people who were unemployed. But Anthony, has that given people some ability to pick and choose what kind of work they want because they have a little bit of cash in the bank?
Yeah, that was a surprising statistic as well. At first, that actually household debt went down in 2020 for, I think, only the second time in the last 35 years. So you can imagine there's a number of people out there who are only at their job because they need the paycheck. And so by saving money during the pandemic, that may have made them more able to quit. And I think the other thing that happened during the pandemic was that many of us, the things that we were spending money on before the pandemic were often social engagement, things for our children, that when the pandemic hit and we went on lockdown, a lot of those expenses went away. Uh-huh. And so it was this sort of forced minimalism where we reduced our expenses. And I think many people aren't picking those expenses back up coming out of the pandemic. So I think people were able to save money in a couple of different ways during that time.
Well, let me go back to Betsy Stevenson. I remember reading during the pandemic for some people, especially low-wage workers, they actually had more income based on unemployment benefits, things like that. That tells you how low their wages were. But there also was this prediction that once unemployment benefits stopped, then people would go back to work. But it doesn't look like that has exactly happened.
So let me provide a little bit of perspective, how like economists think about this, and then sort of directly get to what you asked. So if you think about, you know, why did savings rise? What we see in every recession is that people become really anxious about they could lose their job. It makes sense. In fact, my advice to you would be If the risk of losing your job goes up, you should try to build your precautionary savings so that you don't lose your house.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people did. Honestly, that's what I did when the pandemic hit, because there was so much uncertainty. I didn't know what could happen. I didn't know what would happen to my income, and I certainly didn't want any real pain coming out of a cut. So I started making the easy cuts right away. Well, it turned out, actually, my income didn't go down at all. And that was the truth for a lot of people out there. The pandemic, people were able to work from home. Law firms saw the biggest year that they've had in a while. A lot of firms in 2020 did much better than they had done in 2019. And what that meant was all that cutbacks were unnecessary, because the risk, you know, the risk was there, but it just didn't turn out that a lot of people actually had bad outcomes. And
let me stop.
We're looking at.
Yeah, but let me stop you there. I mean, you're talking about people, professionals who are obviously making, you know, pretty good income. What about people, you know, who were working the supermarket?
Right. And I think what happened with a lot of them is they kept working through the pandemic, despite it being risky and, you know, a job that became way less pleasant. But they, too, were fearful of, what if I can't find another job? What if I can't put food on my family's table? So they got up every day and they went to work in a place where they saw coworkers get sick. Yeah. And some coworkers die. You know, we're past that point. I think a lot of them said, OK, I'm comfortable enough now. The government provided a lot of help, not just in the unemployment insurance, but through the stimulus payments, through the ability to put your mortgage on hold, through the eviction moratoriums. All of those things gave people a little bit of a cushion, and they have that. So they built that cushion up all along the distribution. And then they're looking out there and they're saying, wow, there's a record number of job openings. It's never been a better time to find a better job. That's also true. And what we know is that wage gains come when you change employers. The vast majority of us in our lifetime, our big gains in income will come from changing employers. So what we have is a bunch of workers out there looking around and saying, why should I be working, settling for $12 an hour if I can potentially find a job at 15, 18, 20? So we have a lot of workers making those changes, and they're getting wage increases from making those changes.
And we're almost having a break here, Anthony, but is that one of the reasons why we see this more people quitting, because they see something better out there?
Yeah, so we don't know all the different reasons people are quitting, but I think that's definitely part of it, that increase in wages. At the same time, I've talked to a number of individuals who are taking a break from the workplace and not sure when they'll get back in, or individuals who are going to try to make money through another means, through an entrepreneurial venture, through a hobby, partnering with friends, whatever it may be. And so I think people are also trying to say, is there another way to make money?
Well, we're talking about people quitting their jobs, and you can join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. We want your story, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marnie Moss-Cohen, and we're talking about what has been called the Great Resignation. I also saw it called the Great Reassessment, the Great Reshuffle, the Great Reset, the Great Workquake, the fact that people are quitting their jobs. And we're talking with our guest, Anthony Klotz, who did coin the term the Great Resignation. He's Associate Professor of Management at Mays Business School at Texas A&M, and Betsy Stevenson, Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of Michigan. Anthony Klotz, let me go back to you and go back to those people, and I would include myself, you know, who worked from home for about a year during the pandemic. What did we learn about work, and how do you think that has changed people's ideas about what work is and what they want from their job?
So, yeah, the millions of Americans who were able to work from home essentially took place in maybe the biggest workplace experiment that has ever been conducted in terms of organizations shifting over to having their employees work remotely 100% of the time. And I think it was a mixed bag of pros and cons for employees in terms of the upsides and downsides when it comes to working from home. But one fundamental difference is that working from home gives you more autonomy to structure your workday and your work in the way that you want than working in the office. And as human beings, we have a fundamental need for autonomy and personal freedom. And so I think for many people, they worked remotely and it caused some stress and it caused some upsides. But overall, people were like, I like this freedom and I don't necessarily want to give it up by going hybrid or going back in the office. Now, that's not universal, but I think there are millions of Americans and worldwide more people who really enjoy working remotely and would like to keep doing it.
And do you think that explains, at least to some degree, this quit rate that we're talking about?
I believe it does explain this quit rate, and especially gets more complex when you think that organizations are trying to figure out what work arrangements they want to use going forward. And so you can imagine some organizations are going remote forever, some are going back to in-person, and some are doing something in the middle. And that's why it's called a great reshuffling by some people, because employees are trying to figure out, what arrangement do I want to be in?
Betsy, do you see this as a kind of a temporary glitch in the way that we have approached the world of work? Or are we really witnessing something more revolutionary than that?
So I wouldn't call the high quit rate a glitch. I think it's important to realize in a normal economy, 80% or more than 80% of new jobs are started by people who already have jobs. That's how our economy works, is we shuffle people into new jobs where they're going to be more productive and able to get a higher wage. I think we had a lot of people who were afraid to make a change during the pandemic, so there's some pent-up demand to make that change. Now, I do agree that with everything, you know, that's said about, you know, people had a great rethink about what they want from life, and I see a lot more of an attitude of, you know, I want something different. I want to be able to work from home some of the time. I want to have more time with my kids. You know, one of the most interesting things to me is that fathers have been way less satisfied with time with their kids than mothers.
Really?
Prior to the pandemic. And through the pandemic, father satisfaction at the amount of time they have for their kids has gone up. Hasn't really changed for mothers. I mean, you know, it got a little overwhelming. I love my kids, but it's 24/7. But, you know, for a lot of men who were going to work and not seeing their kids, they actually relished getting a little bit more time. So we're seeing actually even more intentions to balance work and family coming out of fathers than coming out of mothers. So there's definitely something going on. And I think what's unique is that high savings rate coupled with a lot of support from the government has given people the safety net they need to take some time. You know, you asked me earlier, why aren't people coming back? They're absolutely coming back. More than 3/4 of the people who lost jobs during the pandemic or the decline in employment is recovered. So why did it slow? It slowed in August and September due to the Delta variant. But why is it taking more time to come back? Because people are taking their time to find the right job. There's a difference between I'm not looking or working at all and I don't want to work, and I'm going to take the time to find the right thing for me, maybe even exploring self-employment. And we have seen very high entrepreneurial rates. So people are looking to do something different. All that transition and figuring stuff out, it takes time, and that's slowing us down. But I don't think we're in a place where fewer people are going to end up doing something which we could think of as a job, even if it's self-employed.
You know, I was thinking, and I'll put this to you, Anthony Klotz, and also then to you, Betsy Stevenson, that the labor movement seems to have really flourished in the last year or so. I don't know if it's related to the pandemic or not, but you see a lot more union organizing happened here at WHYY. You also see the threat of strikes, Yahtzee, I'm thinking most recently, and also actual strikes that are happening in the country. Does that tell us that workers are, you know, are rising up because they want better working conditions?
Yeah, so one of the questions that I get most is this a moment of worker empowerment sort of writ large? And, you know, in my opinion, that would be one indication, the labor movement having more activity, that it may be, or that workers do feel empowered. Now, I don't know, and I don't know if Betsy could maybe speak to this, but I don't know how wide across the economy it is. I think there are probably some industries that are in very high demand, or that there's sort of some pent-up worker frustration. But I also talked to a number of employees who are still looking for jobs, who were laid off during the pandemic and would like to get back in. And so I think in some sectors of the economy, it seems like workers do feel very empowered and are able to demand retention bonuses or higher pay, but doesn't feel like that's quite universal across the economy.
What do you see, Betsy?
Well, you know, I think another reason we call it the great reshuffling is at the same time that there's some employer out there who says they can't find any workers, there's some worker getting a pink slip. You know, we just saw initial unemployment insurance claims, meaning people who just got laid off. Just last week, we saw that it fell to pre-pandemic levels. We continued to have elevated layoffs. At the same time, employers were saying they couldn't find workers. The problem is we don't have a great mechanism to immediately get, you know, a worker from, you know, business A that is laying people off into business B. And that might be because it's in different sectors. It might be because it's in different physical spaces. You know, it might be because there's a lot of temporary shuffling going on. You know, restaurants that thought they were going to have a lot of people, you know, dining in the fall. And we saw consumer attitudes about doing in-person activities fall from their high in July because of the Delta variant. So there's still a ton of uncertainty. And what that means is that there are still some people who are hurting. You know, I do think that we see overall more worker power. You know, workers are a little bit more empowered than mm-hmm. they have been. We see that because we see wages going up. And I think, you have to understand that all those openings mean the risk you take of either quitting a job or going on strike or turning down an offer that's not quite good enough is lower than it's ever been because of the fact that there's so many opportunities out there to find someone new.
Does that tell us anything that it's a sign of a healthy economy or even a sign of optimism that people feel as if I'm either going to hold out for something better or I feel confident enough that I can quit my job and know that I can get something better out there?
Yeah, it gives people a little more leverage to find the job that fits what they want out of life and pursue well-being through work in the way that fits for them. And I also think it's a time where organizations are very open to experimenting and trying new ways of working. And so I think it is a potentially positive time where organizations are trying to figure out what is it that workers want in this post-pandemic time, if we can call it that, and let's give it a try. And so you see organizations trialing four-day work weeks, shutting down for 2 weeks to help employees recover from burnout, turning off their email servers on the weekend so people aren't checking emails, really asking these probably overdue questions about how do we make sure our workers thrive while they're working for us.
Let me just quickly reintroduce our guests. And we're talking today on Radio Times about the U.S. economy, how the pandemic has upended and in many ways reshaped how we think about work, how we actually go to work, including the fact that it's an interesting phenomenon that people are quitting their jobs. And we want to hear from you, especially if you are one of those people or considering that. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Anthony Klotz, Associate Professor of Management at Mays Business School, that's at Texas A&M University. Betsy Stevenson, Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of Michigan. Betsy, picking up on what Anthony was saying about how managers need to rethink how they manage their employees with all these changes that are going on, what suggestions do you have?
Well, I think that workers are making a bunch of new demands, and if you want to find people that to hire and you want to be able to hang on to them, you got to think about meeting some of those demands. And we're seeing that some employers are, and some employers are holding out. And, you know, it's not you know, it's not really clear what will happen. Like this, I think this is definitely a moment of worker empowerment. The question is, will this moment last? And, you know, if once COVID finally settles down, which, you know, it has not yet, but right. once it finally settles down, if everybody does flood back into the labor market and then we have a ton of people chasing, you know, not quite enough jobs, that's going to evaporate that, you know, worker bargaining power. And so I don't know whether it will last. And I think there are some employers gambling on the fact that it won't. And so they're trying to sort of just get by without trying to change those, what they're offering. But I think savvy employers are adapting because some of the things people want are actually cost saving and productivity enhancing. You know, being able to work from home two or three days a week, it turns out that you can get, you know, the gains from your workers interacting with each other in a few days, and then you can get the productivity gains from them being able to focus on their work at home and save on their commute. You know, that's a big thing. It's just saving on the commute. Workers spend a little bit more time actually doing work rather than commuting. And I think putting that together, you'll see productivity enhancements that mean it's both good for the business and good for the worker.
Do you think, Anthony, that managers know that?
I think some managers do. And I think it's important to recognize just what a tough spot managers and organizations are in. They've spent the last 18 months dealing with the pandemic in their core product line and now having, and maybe they took their focus a little bit away from people and now having to shift back to it in a big way. And you can imagine that there's no one solution that makes all workers happy right now. And so you could consider going fully flexible, fully remote. And there's going to be some people that say, no, I want to see people. I want to be back in the office and I'm going to go find a job that allows me to do that. You have organizations, many of them employ a number of office workers who can work remotely and a number of manufacturing workers who cannot work remotely. And so the manufacturing workers are saying, great, you give the office workers all these flexibility, but what about us? And so in the vaccine mandates have been another challenging aspect for organizations to navigate, with employees on both sides saying they're unhappy with either solution. And so I think that's what organizations are navigating right now, is talking to their employees, collecting data and saying, we have to pick a path or at least experiment with a path going forward and see what happens. And employees are watching.
Well, and that those are equity issues, are they not, Anthony?
Yeah. At the bottom line, these are equity issues, and workers are looking around and saying, what bundle of benefits sort of fit me best? And organizations are trying to meet that to keep people from leaving. And it goes beyond just keeping people from leaving. Organizations obviously want engaged workers, not just individuals who are not leaving. And so I think a lot of them are rethinking work more generally and say, how can we offer a package of benefits that really help our employees engage and thrive?
I mean, Betsy, some works are just pure drudgery.
Well, you know, first of all, Anthony earlier on in the show said, you know, workers really want, because we're human beings, we want control. Now, I believe that 100%. I think that is, you know, really at the core of what people are looking for. I think what happened with the pandemic is we've all changed in terms of what we want. So some people do want to, they discovered they thrived off of the energy of being in the office and they really want to go back and be around people. And other people found that they thrived by being able to spend some time at home and they want to be able to do that. We've got this whole vaccine mandate issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I would not work in person in a place where there were unvaccinated coworkers. I just wouldn't do it.
Me
That's
neither.
Fine. We can all separate. And we could have a, you know, one company that has only unvaccinated people and another company that has only vaccinated people. But that shuffling is going to take some time. The same thing's true when we think about other amenities like, you know, like working from home. How much flexibility do you want to do that? We could think about, you know, being able to live remotely. It's not just working from home, but people started to scatter throughout the country because they realized they could find a cheaper that their geography and their job didn't need to be so linked. Now they can think about these as two separate questions. Where am I going to be happiest living? And where am I going to be happiest working? And before, that was a bundle that they always had to choose. So I think that there are a lot of new options, but that means that companies are going to lose workers as people say, hey, this, what the choices this company is making, it's not working for me. They're going to gain loyalty from other workers and be able to hire new workers. But that, again, is that reshuffling. You know, as you said, though, there's some jobs where they're just pure drudgery.
Yep.
And some of those drudgery jobs, we are actually seeing, you know, technology having stepped in because of the labor shortage. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because there'll always be some workers required. And when there's more technology being used, it'll be easier to pay the workers that remain higher wages.
Anthony, let me go back to you, and perhaps a question I shouldn't have asked a while ago. But if someone is thinking of quitting their job to be one of these people that we've been talking about, how should they think through that decision?
Well, I think it's important first to think about the actual reasons that the person wants to leave their job, and then think about, can I fix those issues before leaving? And so you may think to yourself, my company is going back to in-person work and I want to work remotely. So the first step would be maybe trying going back to the office if you felt safe doing so for a couple days, because as it's been a confusing time. And we're not exactly good at predicting how we'll feel in a future situation that's unknown to us. And so you could always run a small experiment on yourself and try going back in the office. Or if you want to go back to the office, but your company's working remotely, try that out. The second thing ties into our conversation that we've had today is that this is a bit of a moment of worker empowerment. And companies and managers are very keen to retain employees. And so it's a great time for employees to engage in what we call job crafting and turning the job you have into the job you want. So you can imagine that you're quitting because there's 30% of the job that you don't like. Why not have a conversation with your boss and say, I'd like to get rid of this 30% and do more of what I enjoy? And I think organizational leaders are very open to having those conversations, definitely more so than they've been in the past.
Let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Anthony Klotz. He's Associate Professor of Management at Mays Business School. That's at Texas A&M University. Betsy Stevenson, Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of Michigan. We're talking about the U.S. economy, how the pandemic has affected the economy, the fact that people are quitting their jobs, what this means for individuals, businesses, and the overall economy. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We want to know if you have quit your job recently and your reasons for doing that, or if you are considering quitting your job. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Betsy, comment from Chris who says, no one has mentioned that many families may have discovered they can survive without the second income, especially in exchange for more time with the kids and lower child care costs. You think there's some truth to that?
Well, I'm sure that there are some families who have discovered that. I will say that women have come back to jobs at the same rate as men. So that doesn't necessarily mean mothers have come back at the same rate as fathers. But I think that there are strong social norms that make it hard for fathers to decide that the household can get by on just one income, and that it will be the mother who brings that income in. And, I think that it would be great to take a look at how that has changed from the pandemic. But I think the challenge with getting by on one income still today, and I don't think this problem has been solved, is that, you know, you really only have somewhere between 10 and 20 years where you want to be home looking after kids, and our working lives are closer to 50 years. And so what happens to women who step out of the labor force for 10 or 15 years is they make huge sacrifices in terms of what kind of wages they'll ever be able to earn. And I think that's one reason why women have tried to keep a foot in the you know, in the labor force, even when they have kids. And honestly, it is really expensive to pay childcare and the extra taxes. And when you're the second income in your household, you may be thinking, why am I doing this? And I think, you know, the answer is why for a lot of families it does make sense is because, you know, women want to be able to have that independence and assurance that they'll be able to earn an income for the rest of their lives.
Well, let me pick up on that. And this is something I said in my introduction, Anthony, which was that according to the Labor Department, 309,000 women either quit looking for a job or quit their job or quit looking for a job in September. That's a lot of women out of the workforce. Does that tell us something about the world of work as it applies to women and this notion of quitting or at least giving up that search for work for the time being?
Yeah, I think it probably tells us part of what we already knew about that the world of work is particularly challenging on women, and that this pandemic made it worse in a number of ways in terms of schooling children from home and other responsibilities that piled up during this pandemic. And that's pretty depressing to think about, because even before the pandemic, it's not like we were doing extraordinarily well in terms of bringing women equal work and good pay, and that we've been set back now. Again, I think one of the silver linings is for organizational leaders to step back and recognize exactly what you're saying and what Betsy's saying about these statistics and saying, how do we bring these people back into the workplace? How do we bring these women back into the workplace? And that may involve fundamentally rethinking how work is structured. So this magical 40-hour Monday to Friday work week, can we have dignified work at 30 hours a week? Or are there other innovative solutions that we can come up with so that people don't have to choose, so that women don't have to choose between motherhood and a career?
Betsy, I ran across this quote in preparing for today's show. I'm not sure who I can attribute it to, but nonetheless, they said, other countries have social safety nets. The United States has women. Do you agree?
I know that feeling very well. And in fact, I used that quote myself in a paper I wrote. And I'm
Said it. I don't know.
No, I didn't say
okay.
It is a woman by the last name of Peterson. She's a sociologist. And, you know, the idea there was that, you know, other countries didn't have to deal with kids being sent home with absolutely no caregiving. And, you know, women are asked in many ways to be the safety net. So I think what she meant was the safety net in terms of looking after all the kids. And, you know, I've pointed out many times that it's ridiculous that Congress at the very beginning gave more money to a single airline than it gave to the entire childcare sector.
Wow.
And I think that speaks to how Congress saw airlines as part of our important infrastructure. Like, somehow if Delta went bankrupt, the economy wouldn't be able to recover. Of course, if we lost all the childcare centers, they didn't think that would be a problem. So that is an attitude, and that attitude is that, you know, yeah, it's mothers will pick it up. Interestingly to me, though, in most recessions, women are the safety nets because they're the ones who keep working. They're the ones who keep bringing income into their families. And that's, you know, at the beginning of the episode, I said, what's really different here is that it was women who lost their jobs. And it's usually women who are the financial safety nets who are able to keep bringing in income during a recession. So I think that has caused us to look a little bit differently at the recession, at recessions, and what kind of safety nets we have in place.
Well, just picking up on that and knowing what Congress is doing, Anthony Klotz, even as we speak, which is, debating about, I hate the name Build Back Better, but nonetheless, that's what it is called, you know, a series of programs and policies to, I guess, help us through this period and look into the future, maybe $2 trillion, maybe more, I do not know. But so much of that are programs and policies to help families, to support children, to support, you know, free kindergarten or preschool.
Yeah, so preschool, paid parental leave, there's a lot of important family forward packages in that. And a lot of these already exist in other countries, to the point that you're making. And so they're not necessarily revolutionary worldwide. In some ways, they're just getting us caught up to a lot of where the rest of the world is at. And I think if we're not going to support women as much as we should support families, that leaves us in a pretty dangerous spot, because during the pandemic, I think a lot of Americans rethought the place of work in their lives and said, what is this bringing me versus what it's taking out of me? And I think that is part of what's driving this great resignation, is typically as Americans, we define ourselves very much in terms of work, in terms of our profession. And a lot of the individuals that I'm talking to, a lot of what I've seen is that people are now questioning that and saying, to Betsy's earlier point, fathers are saying, I really enjoyed taking care of kids during the pandemic. And so you have these realizations being made. And if, as a country, we're not going to create a situation in which you can have a family and have a career, people are going to not opt out of the workforce, and I don't think that's good for anyone.
Well, let me pick up on something that you're referencing there, Anthony Klotz, and I remember doing programs about the fact that Americans generally don't take all the vacation days that they're due, unlike, I think, our European counterparts. Does it tell us that, I mean, if we're thinking about the world of work, that we have to think about it differently somehow, to be more caregiving of ourselves?
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity to make work more sustainable and to recognize that a healthy individual isn't all about work. I mean, work is one of their cherished identities, but they also have other aspects of their life that are very important to them, and that work gives them the room to nurture. And so you're exactly right. When we look at like Americans out of office assistance, where we say, you know, we're going to be out for surgery or something, but we're available by email, compare that to the out of office assistance in other parts of the world, I believe there is an opportunity to create a world of work where we get to psychologically detach in the U.S. And that's really dealing with some of the burnout that we're facing right now, is if we take vacation, we're checking email during vacation. The research is really clear that any psychological benefits that you get from vacation are gone if you check your work email during vacation. And then I come back to a huge pile of work and the stress comes right back. And so rethinking the place of work and how we manage it between organizations and employees, I think this is just a great opportunity to revisit those fundamental questions.
You're an economist, Betsy Stevenson. So what is your definition of a healthy economy?
So I agree, particularly it's high wage workers and highly educated workers who are working way too many hours. And it's really cheating our GDP. Like, we think we're producing a lot, but we're doing it through brute force by working a lot of hours instead of by being smarter about how we work and taking more vacation. And, you know, frankly, there are countries in Europe that have slightly lower GDPs, but a whole lot more vacation. And that sounds nicer to me. The real challenge is that lower wage workers in the United States actually don't get enough hours. Mm-hmm. And so we've got this bifurcated society where there's too much work at the top. And that's partially because we're chasing too much income at the top because of our massive income inequality. And then we've got lower wage workers who are just struggling to get, you know, one good full-time job that would provide a living wage so that they're not juggling two jobs and trying to manage two different schedules, which creates a lot of complexity and pain and suffering.
Well, I'm thinking a lot of these low-wage jobs, Anthony Klotz, are, you know, in, say, the fast food industry. Oftentimes, those workers don't have any control over their schedule.
Yep, I think that's one of the most frustrating and probably contributes most to employee dissatisfaction, is just that lack of control and not knowing how much work you're going to get and not knowing when it's going to come. And I think schedules for in-person work is a great opportunity for organizations to be more innovative. And all the discussion about flexible work right now focuses on remote work. And I think there's a great opportunity to turn that lens on shift work and say, what does flexible work look like for in-person shift workers? How do we craft their schedules such that they could take a month off if they wanted to and still make enough money to have a good living?
I mean, that sounds very enlightened. How common is that, Anthony?
So I think if we're talking about fast food workers, it's pretty rare. Yeah. But if you talk about organizations that I mentioned earlier that maybe are a manufacturing company with a lot of office workers as well, in some cases they have offered really innovative ways to structure shift work such that if maybe you work a week on, you can take 2 weeks off. And we see it in healthcare with doctors as well. So it does exist. And I think there's an opportunity just to spread that throughout more industries.
I was reading, Betsy Stevenson, that during the pandemic, billionaires, you know, made something like $2.1 trillion more than they had before the pandemic. Just to underscore what you were saying about this disparity between the very, very wealthy and the fact that there's so many, I guess, what, working poor people in this country.
Yes. And it's easy to point to those billionaires, but it's more than the billionaires. You know, I pointed out that law firms did really well. We saw, you know, a lot of health professionals at the end of the day ended up doing really well. Sort of everyday businesses, you know, some of them really struggled if they have in-person customers, but other ones that were providing sort of services that could be done online, they were able to get their employees to work even harder, you know. And I think one of the complaints you've heard from employees is that sort of burnout of that, you know, 24/7 work. You know, when it comes to schedules for lower wage workers, in the Obama administration, we were trying to deal with that problem. You know, I don't know if you remember clopening, the idea that you might be scheduled to work till 11 p.m. and then have to report back for a 4 a.m. shift because you were both a closer and an opener on those, you know, days. And we brought in, you know, the companies that use these big algorithmic scheduling, and we brought in the algorithmic schedulers. And, you know, the company said, oh, we just do what the scheduling software tells us. And the scheduling software people were like, look, we just program the software to do what you say. So what you need is companies say, we're going to put real people's needs into these schedules.
We're almost out of time here. And I mean, at some point we're going to get to, if not the end of this pandemic, where it is more under control. And do you see what we've been talking about during this hour as something that can be sustained when it comes to having a more humane workplace or more flexibility for workers or, you know, more ability to have control over your life? Do you see that in your crystal ball, Anthony Glotz?
Yes, I do.
And it's
a pretty optimistic crystal ball. But I think a lot of organizations are experimenting right now, and you're going to end up with, whereas before in the pandemic, most work was pretty traditionally structured. And organizations are experimenting with all different types of work structures now. And so I could see a future in which maybe when you are early in your career, you want to work in person and be in the office to get that development. And then when you start a family, you might want to go hybrid. And then later in your career, when you have a little bit more income or wealth saved up, you can go fully remote and live and work somewhere else or travel. But I think there's going to be more work arrangements so that people can find the arrangement that fits them and their career stage. Or at least that's my hope.
That's your hope. What's your hope, Betsy Stevenson?
Yeah. You know, I think actually it's very similar. You know, I hope that people are able to better arrange their working lives and their family lives. I think we've learned a lot more about what we need to ask for. And I think employers have learned that they can actually give more without sacrificing productivity. You know, we've been fighting for paid family leave for so long and workplace flexibility for so long and really gotten, you know, nowhere. And I now think, you know, paid family leave should really be about that kind of tiered, some full time off at home with your kids, and then you come back remotely on a short, you know, schedule, and you sort of phase your way back into work. And gosh, I wish for my kids that's what they have available to them when it comes time to having children and starting a family.
Well, amen to that. Betsy Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of Michigan, Anthony Klotz, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He is Associate Professor of Management at Mays Business School at Texas A&M University. Go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.